All right, well, welcome everybody to this year's BP lecture. The BP Visiting Professorship has, over the years, attracted a whole sequence of very distinguished economists to spend a year in the Department of Economics here, and it is a great pleasure to introduce to you our speaker for this year, Luca Anderlini. Luca graduated with a PhD in Cambridge and taught subsequently at the University of Cambridge, was a professor at Southampton, and he is now a professor at Georgetown University in the United States. He has contributed over the years to a huge range of areas of economic theory. He has spanned public economics, bounded rationality, and game theory. And he has, in particular over recent years, become increasingly involved in the hot topic of complexity and computability and the relationship of these ideas to the foundations of the theory of games, all of which sounds quite wonderfully abstract. But he is also a theorist whose wide interests lead him to explore the implications of economic analysis for a range of practical issues. And this evening he's going to be talking to us about an area into which economists have strayed with increasing frequency and quite some success over more than a decade now, the area which lies at the interface of economics and law. It's a pleasure to introduce this year's BP professor to give his lecture. I'll give the floor to Luca Anderlini.
Thank you, John. I need to recover some piece of technology here. Thank you, everyone, for coming. So my title is On the Economics of Legal Systems and Courts. This is, for us at least, a new topic. It comes from an interest in contract theory, which in turn is linked to an interest in bounded rationality, as John pointed out. obviously, I start with some acknowledgments. Many thanks to the LSE. This has been a very productive and enjoyable year, and to BP, obviously. The other acknowledgments are that everything I say tonight, especially if there's something wrong with it, is co-authored with Leonardo Felli, who is a professor here at the LSE, and he's sitting right there. this is a sort of I'm going to try and give you a punchline that comes from one paper, really. But there are several linked papers, and some of them are also joint with Andrew Postlewaite, who is at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm afraid this is going to get pretty dry in parts. Hopefully, you will manage to bear with me. So I decided to start a little bit more on the light side. hopefully, so take the following few slides as on the light side. Hopefully, they'll also mean something by the time I'm done. So this section I decided to title "Time Travel." That's because we're going to go back and forth through time. so my topic, remember, is what do courts really do, and how does this matter in terms also of the legal system in which they are embedded. It's very difficult to find lawyers writing about their sort of philosophy of how they see the law. They do sometimes, but not often. there's one famous former Supreme Court Justice of the United States who, in the 1920s, was in fact more prone than most other lawyers to philosophize, as well as being, of course, a very effective, very well-respected U.S. Supreme Court justice. So here's his view. I think this comes from a book called The Nature of the Judicial Process. So there are three things here. First of all, he's extremely pragmatic about the fact that law is It's not something about principles or rules. Law never is. It is always about to be. It is realized in the judgment, and then immediately after that, it expires. Yeah, there's the school, I think, is called legal realism. It's an extremely pragmatic view of what the judicial process is. Notice, and I'll come back to this. He's also pretty pessimistic here. There are only isolated dooms. That's pretty tough stuff. He goes on to say, well, you know, the ideal system, if we had it, would be a code so flexible and so minute as to supply in advance for every conceivable situation in the just and fitting rule. Life is too complex, and this is not within the compass of human powers. So there's a view of the law as something that clearly is dynamic. It moves through time. It evolves through time. It underscores the fact that codes that can do everything for you are not possible, and it's pessimistic, as I said there. The next slide, you'll see why I call this time travel. And I know there's at least one medieval historian in the room, so take this on the light side. Don't try to nail me to any of this, because I won't. 1,392 years earlier, Justinian, the Emperor Justinian, he ruled the empire from Constantinople, he was just about, I think, the last one to rule over most of what is now modern Italy. So he ruled over Rome, but from Constantinople. In fact, the mosaic is in Ravenna. It's in Italy. It's not in Constantinople. I don't think I'm saying something too wrong if I say he must have had a pretty different view of what the law ought to be. If you punch civil law into the catalog of Georgetown University Library, this is what comes up, the Corpus Juris Civilis. I was hoping to avoid a trip to the library because I wanted to know how thick it was. It turns out that the trip to the library was unavoidable. I had to go there because it's like eight in the bounded form volumes, the original volumes as in what constitutes a volume, probably more. And I took my calculator and it adds up to 5,818 pages. That's a pretty thick statute book. It contains pretty detailed rules. Here's one. It is straight up. That's it. I haven't edited that. That's law number 8 of table number 8. If a road is straight, it should be 8 feet wide, and if it curves, it should be 16 feet wide. Okay. So this is clearly an attempt at doing something that Cardozo didn't quite see as possible. And I'm Italian, so I'm allowed this. 1,471 years later, this idea of making rules can go pretty wrong. This is a law of the Republic of Italy. It's a bit unfair to Berlusconi because he wasn't actually prime minister in 2000. but basically, if you read it, it's a bizarre, convoluted rule about what you should do if a birth happens on a moving train, which is a bizarre thing to make a rule about, I think. it says, you know, the exact procedure that you should follow. And what I like about this is that notice that this was a regulation issued because of a law that was passed before as a decree, and the law ordered the streamlining of procedures. Yeah, this is an attempt at streamlining. Hopefully, by the time I'm done, you'll see why I go back and forth between these three things. And that's the end of the lighter part. Now I want to say a little bit more specifically, still generally, hopefully, what type of question I want to try and ask, and to begin to answer. I should stress that I consider this the beginning of an answer, not, of course, something that I'm wrapping up. It is obviously too far too big a question, and whenever one writes down models that are analytically tractable that can say anything about the question, you're obviously slicing off important parts of the question. So I'll be focusing on certain aspects, and I'm not denying that there may be others that are important. So first of all, remember, I'm talking about the law, and I'm an imposter, really, in that sense. Okay, I'm an economist. So I want to say whether economics has something to say about whether it is better to write detailed rules in a big book, and I'm going to be calling this the statute law regime, or write vague or even no rules and leave the courts to decide. I'm going to call this the case law regime. You may wonder why I choose these rather than others, and I'll come back to the other names that these things might have, but they are, of course, controversial. So this is Cardozo, and this is Justinian. Okay, I'm just impersonating these two things in those two characters. So if you ask this to an economist, I think that most economists in this room would agree that these are the sort of gut reactions that one would have if you're trained in economics. The things that one should consider. First of all, leaving things to the court seems a way to decentralize the decisions where more detailed information is. Economists are, of course, very, very interested. You can argue that a lot of economics is about this. The world is complicated. Obviously, if you try to decide everything from the center, you end up with some version of the Soviet Union. Of which, of course, was a failed experiment. So if you decentralize decisions to where more information lies, you're probably doing a good thing, rather than trying to decide everything from the center. Moreover, this is one of the reasons why decentralizing is important. Remember, Cardozo, life is too complex. Okay, from the center, we have no hope, in a sense, of writing down everything that is necessary to write down. So these two things together seem to say that the case law regime should be a good idea. This, for those who like economic jargon, basically I'm saying that I'm interpreting the Cardozo sentence as telling us that laws are necessarily incomplete. Okay, this is the prevailing jargon. On the other hand, economists learn about externalities and various other things early on. What are courts? Courts are things that rule over others. Okay, so they take decisions that are they don't necessarily affect themselves, but they affect the parties that come before the court. And whenever a decision maker takes decisions that concern directly others, we should be, before we say that that's a good thing, we should be concerned with what the motives are. Okay, when people decide for themselves about how many onions to buy or how many bananas to buy, we don't have really a problem with that. The minute you start saying that people take decisions that directly affect others, we should be careful that that they have the right objectives. So we should be sure that the courts have social welfare in mind. Social welfare has a very precise meaning to economists. To the general public, of course, is a vague term. I'm going to have to ask you to trust me that this is meaningful in a pretty widely accepted social sense of the word. So, conclusion of these gut reactions: if the court motives are right, and this is again partly to be specified later, then the case law regime ought to be superior. Okay, so this is, I think, a fair summary of how one might start thinking about this. My punchline, on the other hand, and I wouldn't be here giving this lecture if it didn't differ from the initial gut reaction, is that in some cases there's good reason to think that instead statute law may be superior. why is that? This is because the case law courts, even if they have the right motives, may suffer from what I would be calling present bias or time inconsistency. What's at the root of what's at the root of this? At the root of this is the simple observation, which will drive a lot of what I say, which is that there is a difference between the time at which contractual agreements are made, that is, contractual agreements are made before a bunch of things are realized, some uncertainty is resolved, some other actions are taken, perhaps people invest after they sign contracts and so on, and the time at which a contract is brought before a court for the court to decide, if it is brought before the court. The difference between these two will, even if the court has exactly the right objective function in mind, will create a difference between what is right socially and what is right in the eyes of the court that will drive the main point home. My conclusion, what do I mean by in some cases? I mean that when the pool of cases that the court needs to deal with is sufficiently homogeneous, i.e. relatively alike with each other, then the drawbacks of rigidity, the drawbacks of making a rule that spans over cases of different varieties, are outweighed by the cost of the present bias or time inconsistency. Just to be absolutely sure, when I say present bias, I don't mean I don't use that in the currently fairly fashionable meaning of behavioral economics. Just to avoid misunderstandings with economists, I just mean the difference between ex ante and ex post with standard objective functions. I promised that I would go back to other names that my statute law regime and my case law regime may have. And here it is. Does this have anything to do with the distinction between civil law and common law? Civil law, England is a civil law country. England is a common law country. France is a civil law country. When we first started thinking about this, we thought that what we're doing here was relatively close to the distinction between these two systems. It turns out that this is extremely controversial, so I don't want you to take this as an analysis of the comparative advantages of civil law versus common law. A very illuminating paper for me to read about this was a paper by Gillian Hatfield, who's at the University of Southern California Law School. First of all, the differences between the civil law and the common law systems are not just, if they are these, they're not just these, there are many others. Judges are selected and promoted in very different ways. The jurisdictions of various courts is extremely different across the two systems and so on. But why doesn't this distinction sort of capture what I'm saying here in terms of statute law versus case law? Well, the motive is simple, and Gillian, by the way, was the first one to answer me straight on this. A lot of other lawyers gave me very useful answers, but very guarded ones. Essentially, common law countries have accumulated a lot of statutes through time. The United States is a prime example. I mean, the United States has a tax code that wouldn't fit on this platform. Many civil law countries, of course, have had opportunities to revise and adapt their statutes. So it's not clear that if you give them sufficient time, the statute book doesn't adapt. The best example of this, I was told, is Holland, which has a spick and span modern civil code, which took place in the last 10 or 15 years. So what am I doing here? One good way to interpret this is an exercise which is relatively familiar to economists, which is an exercise in design. Okay, so suppose we were designing legal arrangements from scratch. Then what I'm going to say here is that in some circumstances, and when I say some circumstances, hopefully it'll be clear later on, I mean not necessarily we pick this country and we give it statute law, and we pick this country and we give it common law. I mean even legal fields within the same system. In some circumstances, so even with fields within the same legal system, it'll be better to go with case law. And in some others, it'll be better to go with statute law. The optimal regime is most likely to combine the two. essentially when it is possible to fine-tune the statute book, and when is that going to be? When is that plausible? Well, in our view, this is of course more plausible in slow-changing environments, simply because you have more time to tailor the laws and collect the information that is necessary. Then statute law is probably superior. Say, if we're talking about land ownership rights, that doesn't seem like a bad idea. If the environment, on the other hand, changes very rapidly or is too complex, obviously that's a hard word to pin down, then case law is probably superior. There is a large literature, for instance, on finance, which I will cite later on, or patents would be another good example. Second, our design exercise basically says that once you take the plunge in one direction or in another, if you go with statute law, then you should strive to write laws that are as detailed as possible. Whereas if you go with common law, then you should be careful to design the playing field as more loosely in the first place. So once you pick your system, you should go relatively far in one direction or relatively far in the other direction, according to which system you pick. Okay, this is now going to get even drier, because I want to show you some pieces of machinery that allow me to carry out this exercise and to justify my assertions analytically. Hopefully, even those who will miss on the technical stuff, of which there is as little as possible, the purpose of this is to give you an idea of what the bits and pieces are that one should put together in an analytical piece of machinery that gets this exercise going. First of all, when I talk about the law, I said this at the beginning, I'm an economist, I'm talking about contracts, yeah? Contracts for transacting various things between economic agents. This is not about murder, okay? I have nothing to say about that. The first observation is this, that with perfect contracts, which is something that economists sort of assumed without knowing it for the best part of the history of economic thought until recently, with perfect frictionless contracts, then of course we'll have very little to do. Parties are smart; they write down everything that should be written down, and then all there is to do is, if people have perfect contracts, then the perfect statute book is simple to write. Anybody who breaches any contract is punished extremely severely. That's it. End of story. It's a one article statute book. So the first ingredient I need is that the contracts that parties write are imperfect in some sense, are what economists call incomplete. Talking about contracts, I want to be a little bit more explicit about the type of object that I mean. The first distinction that will be convenient to make, although not incredibly important here, is because we're going to be talking about so-called ex-ante contracts all the time, is between spot and ex-ante contracts. What's a spot contract? You buy fish at the market. Okay, that's it. You go, the guy gives you the fish, you give him the money, end of story. No more details. What's an ex-ante contract? An ex-ante contract is, let's say, you buy insurance. That's the simplest example. You part with your premium. Then there's a contract that says that if something happens, the insurance pays. If something else happens, the insurance does not pay. There's two stages. First, there is an agreement. There's something that happens. And then there is settlement. There is a settlement stage. I would buy fish at the market without a written contract. Everybody does, and I would probably buy fish at the market also in a country where the legal system isn't too well oiled. I would not buy insurance in such a country. Okay, so contracts become important at that stage. The type of ex-ante contract that I'd be talking about is something which has become sort of canonical in a lot of exercises, and the chief example is something that went on between Fisher Body and General Motors. General Motors took over Fisher Body over some years, but I think the deal ended in 1926. Fisher Body was producing bodies for cars. In particular, it was producing doors for General Motors. And the stylized sequence of events here is that first Fisher Body and General Motors specify a price for the doors. Then Fisher Body has to invest, because doors are extremely detailed things. They either fit the car or they don't. They're extremely relationship specific, as economists like to say. They don't go for more than one situation. Then Fisher Body would produce the doors, and then it would deliver them and paint them. Now notice here again there is an ex ante stage, specify your price, and then there is some stuff that happens in between, and then delivery and payment. Okay, so this is clearly what I was calling an ex ante contract. Why is this ex ante contract important? Why isn't it like buying fish at the market? Well, precisely because of what I said a minute ago, which is that if you think about it, without a contract that specifies ahead of time what's going to happen, this transaction becomes extremely difficult. Because if you don't specify the price ahead of time and various other details of the contract, then Fisher Body is going to be stuck with doors that have an outside resale value, which is very little because they don't fit any other cars. And so if the investment that that Fisher Body has to make in order to make the correct doors is substantial, there is a danger that this transaction will not go ahead at all. In fact, the relationship between GM and Fisher Body was so difficult that the sort of solution historically was that General Motors took over Fisher Body. Okay? So when I say a contract, I'm specializing things more and more. Essentially, I need the process of this kind. So far, this is stuff that is extremely widespread in the economic literature, and that canonical sequence of events has given rise to extremely fruitful analysis in the last 15 years of institutions of, for instance, in addressing questions of efficient allocation of property rights, control, authority, and so on. To get my exercise off the ground, I need another ingredient. I need to say what the courts do. Okay, and that's again not particularly obvious. So I'm interested in contracting parties that are sophisticated. Okay. You can imagine courts correcting people's mistakes. But here I'm talking about, hopefully, something that applies to big, sophisticated firms. They make few mistakes. They have lots of experts. They have legal departments. They have all kinds of things that minimize the role of those things. In that case, it's not obvious how you come up with a role for active courts, that is, courts that actually intervene in the contractual relationship between these parties, beyond, of course, sitting in the background and enforcing rather complex contracts in some cases if people don't adhere to them. Together with Leonardo and with Andy, we've explored at least two possibilities. I want to mention them both, and then from this point on, I will run with only one of them. The first is, and this is not what the focus of my talk tonight will be, they could be acting so as to protect parties against uninsurable risk. So the parties, when they write the contract, they know that there is some risk out there that might hit them, but they don't have the means to write this into their contract. Then a bunch of things happen. They may be good, they may be bad, and exposed. In some cases, something so bad happens that the court decides to void the parties' contracts and let them off the hook. This is one way to look at this. Many contracts contain an act of God clause, and the court here decides, you put in this contract is void in case of an act of God. That's obviously not a very specific set of circumstances, and the court exposed decides what is an act of God. Okay, decides when the contract should be void. there is another possible role for courts that we have modeled explicitly, and that is ensure appropriate disclosure of information. You're going to see this in action quite explicitly, but basically here the courts say, we will intervene if you contracting parties do certain things. And by doing so, they will ensure, if the parties believe that the court will intervene and void the contract in certain circumstances, this will foster the disclosure of information that one party might have and the other party might not. Okay? And typically, this is a good thing for efficiency. In other words, somebody knows something ahead of time, the other party doesn't, and if they foresee that the court will impede certain things, then they might have an incentive to reveal the information that they have, and so trade becomes more efficient. This will be quite explicit with some numbers. and the disclosure of information is what we're gonna run with tonight. And this is coming right now. So let's say that there is a buyer and a seller. The buyer, you could think of the buyer as a house owner and the seller as a contractor coming to do some work. let's say that you are contracting with this guy to change the windows on the exterior of your house in Georgetown, which is where I live. And notice that this is a very heavily regulated area. Permits are required for everything in Georgetown. I think the most you can do is change the color of your house. If you change the shape of your windows, even just by a little bit, then you need a permit. we're going to think of two types of environment, one that I call simple, and the symbol for that will be F, which happens with a certain probability. So never mind probabilities. It happens a certain fraction of the times. And also notice that I'm thinking, remember the Fisher Body General Motors example, that basically the buyer needs to invest something. He has to sort of move the stuff away from the windows, prepare the house for the intervention by the contractor. The buyer has some private information. Remember, the buyer here is the house owner. So he knows something that the seller doesn't. Okay. So in economics jargon, these are called types. And the buyer knows one thing or knows the other with equal probability, just to keep things simple. What are these numbers? Basically, there are two ways to do the windows. One is obtaining the appropriate permit, and the other is without obtaining the appropriate permit. What are the C's here and the V's in each one of the boxes? They are the cost of performing the work from the part of the contractor and the value to the house owner. Okay? So just look at the top line here. This means that the cost of performing the work with permit is 1, the value is 22, the cost of performing the work without permit is 1, and the value is 26. The value without permit is higher because the house owner doesn't have to waste time going to get the permit. this is one type of buyer, and this guy, this is somebody who really likes his house. Okay, so the values here are high, quote unquote, 22 and 26. Then there is also a buyer who doesn't value this as much, and the values are low. They're 1 in this case and 4 in this case. Again, reflecting, the values are higher in this column, reflecting the fact that there is some savings in not obtaining the permit. What happens in this case? Remember, this is a simple environment. There's not going to be any surprise yet. for the economists in the room, I'm assuming, to make things simple, that there is a take it or leave it offer from the buyer to the seller. Then both types will sign a contract without obtaining the permit, and the price is equal to 1. You can think of the contractors as being competitive. I wish they were in real life. They're probably not. But what happens here is that basically whatever the buyer knows, if he knows that he's the guy who likes his house a lot or not, they both sign. They both say, let's go ahead without the permit, and the price is 1. Then I want another possibility to take place, which I will call the rich environment, and the symbol will be M. And this happens a certain fraction of the times, rho. there's something else that can be done, which is once the contractor is in the house, you can decide that there's a problem with your basement, and ask the contractor to do something about your basement dampness in your basement. In this case, the two types of buyer, what the buyer knows, is very important, okay, or is potentially very important. The basement is important for both types. The point is that here the value is 60, so this is somebody who neither of them particularly likes dampness in their basement, and this is a straightforward job. You just need to dry it up, to mop it, let's say. Okay, so the cost is very low. However, everybody knows that once you start dealing with dampness, you never know where you end. And there's also a possibility, which is the case for the high, the high valuation buyer, that the value is high, the value of drying up the basement is high, but the cost is even higher. Okay, this is a mess. This is a mess of a basement. And once you start working on it, the costs pile up. And in fact, the costs of drying up the basement exceed the benefit to the buyer. Notice, I'm assuming that the drying up the basement, because it's in the basement, you don't need to prepare for it. This can be done without investment on anybody's part. What happens in this case? Well, what happens in this case, again, is that both types of buyer, in other words, the buyer does not reveal his information. They still go for the no permit work, and the price is one. Now, what happens here is that because the buyer does not reveal his information, the seller, of course, doesn't know whether the cost of drying up the basement is high or low. So basically, they start the work in the basement in either case. And this is inefficient. The reason it's inefficient is that an inefficient transaction takes place. This is something that should not be transacted. This is something that the value of which, okay, the buyer likes it, but once you take into account how much the buyer likes it and how much the seller dislikes it, you reason that that should not take place. Notice this is a loss of 24. If you add up these numbers, so value minus cost, that's what economists call surplus. That's the social benefit to these transactions. You divide them by two because they have equal probability, you end up with 31. Now, here's what the court can do to avoid this inefficiency. suppose that the court intervenes and says, look, guys, I'm not going to enforce, I'm going to void the contract without the permit. Then the transaction without the permit will be impossible for the reasons that have to do with GM and Fisher body, because essentially exposed the you will not be able to recoup the investment. But think of this as the court manages to forbid somehow the transaction without the contract. Then what happens is that, remember, the H buyer really likes his house. Okay, so whether he has to spend the time obtaining the permit or not, the value goes down a little, but he still wants to sign the contract, this time with permit, because without permit it's impossible. The low buyer gives up because it's too much to go and obtain the permit. His value is relatively low. Now, at this point, if this is how the situation works, what the buyer with some one type of information acts in one way, the buyer with another type of information acts another way, that means that the seller, just by looking at what people do, learns which one is the case. Are we in the high-cost case for the basement or in the low-cost case for the basement? So basically, once you observe that the guy signs a contract with the permit, you know that the basement is messed up and you don't do the work, but the type with the low valuation is still able to have the basement dried up. The total expected surplus, again, remember, this is the social value of these transactions, is 40. Okay, that's an increase of 9 from before. This is just to say, essentially, which is not really the main point here, that what I've set up is a simple situation in which it is beneficial, it is socially beneficial for the court to intervene in the contractual relationship between these two parties. Why is that so? Because the court will force the buyer to reveal some of the information that he has and the seller does not have, and some transaction that should not take place will be avoided. When I say should not take place, of course, I mean from a social point of view. Okay. Now, this is the point I made before, which is contracts don't go to court at the time you sign them. They go to court if and when something happens. Okay, at the end, they go to court, if they go to court, at the end of the story. So I want to argue that by the time the court sees the contract, it will have an incentive not to intervene. So imagine now that basically the parties have gone ahead ignoring the fact that the court said, oh, I'm going to void contracts with no permit. They just go ahead. They do their thing without the permit. The buyer does the little investment that he needs to do, and they're doing something that they shouldn't do. And then they go to the court and say, what should we do now? Well, the court will have an incentive to take the easy decision, which is to say, well, you guys go, and that's fine. You've done it now. Go ahead without the permit. The transaction should take place. The payment should take place. Why does a completely benign court do that? Well, because basically bygones are bygones. The parties have made all their decisions. They're irrevocable. Either they've revealed information or they haven't. Either they've invested or they haven't. There's nothing that the court can do about that. What has happened has happened. So essentially, if the court voids, it will prevent a profitable trade at that point. There's no issue of what information should be revealed or not. The information either has been revealed or it hasn't by the time you go to court. So notice, again, for the economists in the room, I'm assuming here that if the court voids, the surplus vanishes. This transaction becomes impossible. That's, of course, extreme, although in the case of very complex transactions, it's very, very obvious to presume that the value of the transaction without the backing of the court will be lower, simply because transacting without the backing of the court that sits in the background at this point and enforces the terms becomes a lot harder. You have to take all kinds of precautions about being paid versus not being paid. You use escrow accounts or things of that nature. So, but for simplicity here, I'm just assuming that if the court voids, nothing is possible anymore. So by the time you go to court, even though before, remember, to intervene was better than not to intervene, by the time you go to court, when the court looks at what's before her, what's come from here on, the surplus, remember this is the social value of the transactions, is 32 if it does not intervene, but it's 18 if it voids the contract. Okay, so the right thing for the court to do is one before the fact, and it's another for after the fact. I've summarized here for those of. I know that these are going to give a headache to somebody, but basically what this is the social value, the payoff to the court, if we are in the simple environment and it voids, if we're in the simple environment and it upholds, and this is for the complex environment, void, complex environment, uphold. That's before anything happens. And this is by the time the contract goes to court. Okay. So what I want you to take away from here is that 40 is bigger than 31, but on the other hand, 18 is lower than 32. Okay, so what the court, what is the right thing for the court to do? In principle, if it could announce credibly that this is what it's going to do, is to say contracts without permit are not valid. But by the time you go to court, a court that maximizes social value of trade, so I'm making the court completely benign here, it has an incentive to say, well, you guys have done it now, why don't you go ahead and trade? Okay, so this reversal this being bigger than this and this being reversed here is the source of my present bias or time inconsistency for the court. Okay, now I have all the ingredients, and what I want to do is to examine the two cases in which, in one case, I design a rigid rule, which in fact I'm going to set up almost as a straw man. I want to rig, if anything, I want to be accused of rigging the problem against statute law, because I want to conclude that it is superior in some cases, which is not the normal conclusion. So what happens under statute law in these circumstances? We now imagine that there is a sequence of these cases and a sequence of time periods in which a sequence of these contracts take place. If we're under statute law, what we're going to do is we're going to force all courts to act the same way. We're going to write a specific rule that says either contracts without a permit are valid or they're not. and that's it. And we're going to make sure that all courts act in the same way. They're bound by the rule that we write in the statute book. And this is because we don't have access to the detailed information. We don't know which cases might come up. So we have to make the same ruling in the case of a simple environment in which there's nothing wrong with not having a permit, and the complex environment in which you should be voiding the contract without the permit, because that fosters the disclosure of information. So what are we going to write in the optimal statute book? Well, we're going to uphold if the simple environment is more likely. Remember, that is rho being low. Rho is the fraction of the times that the environment is simple. And we're going to pick B if M is more likely. In other words, if overall the situation in which voiding is good is more likely, then we're going to write in the statute book that no way people can have contracts without permits that are enforceable. This is for my colleagues, just so that you know what underlies this. This would be the problem, the trivial problem that you would be solving. Okay, so I'm having discounting here. This is the way to read this is that this is what I'm taking is a bunch of courts through time. T denotes time. These are the payoffs, and this is the relative frequency of the two environments. Just to go back to the simple numbers, basically, if the simple environment happens less than a quarter of the time, then you should choose to write uphold in the statute book. If rho is greater than one quarter, then you should write in the statute book that all contracts without permit should be void, and that's it. Leave there's no flexibility in here. And what I'm going to call this is the entire social welfare from the beginning to the end of time. I'm just making up a symbol for it. So this is, remember, this is in part a straw man, okay? We're just constrained to take always the same decision, and obviously if it's more likely that we run into situations in which voiding intervention is optimal, we're going to write that there should be intervention. If it's less likely, that we run into a situation in which intervention is optimal, we're going to write the courts should not intervene. So now let's look at the case law regime. First of all, the case law court here is going to be able. We're going to defer decisions to the courts unless, of course, they're bound by precedents. Precedents here are going to play a crucial role. So the court can basically gauge whether we're in the complicated environment or not. And therefore can, if it's not bound by precedents, take different decisions according to whether we are in a situation in which intervention in that particular case is socially optimal or not. So it can pick two different rulings, unless, of course, it is bound by precedents. And that in the Latin in brackets is my understanding of what lawyers call upholding precedents. Everybody here is very smart, okay? So everybody knows whether the precedents are binding or not, everybody in every period. what happens here, again, please ignore this if you don't like random variables, but basically what I'm imagining here is that in every period there's two random variables, L for legalese. These are the legal aspects of each case. They're variables in 0, 1. Everybody observes this. And then what is a set of precedents? A set of precedents is simply two sets of cutoffs, VF, UF, VM, UM, with this being below that, and these two also in this inequality. And basically, if this is the state of precedents, what happens is that, let's say we're in an environment F, the court is free to choose if we're between the cutoffs. It's bound to uphold if we're above the UF cutoff. It's bound to void if we're below the VF cutoff. Okay, so I'm not married to this particular way of modeling precedence. This seemed a very parsimonious way to capture the idea that in every period it might be the precedents bind in one direction, the precedents bind in the other direction, or that the case law court is simply left to decide because there are no precedents that are sufficiently close in order to bind its decision. Okay. So what I want you to take away from this, aside from the technicalities, is that there are these precedents which may or may not apply. If they apply, they may apply in one direction or in another. And if they don't apply, then the case law court just decides. So in each case law court is going to take the precedents as given. That's it. That's written in the published in the case database that is not available to all. They're actually quite expensive to have access to. And what it does is it rules today. There are some parties that go before the court today. It picks its ruling. It decides whether to intervene or not intervene. And it may intervene or not intervene because it's bound by precedents. But in some cases, it will do so exercising its discretion. Remember, that's the case in which the precedents do not bind. And what will that do? It will change the precedents for tomorrow's cases. Okay. So there is a new ruling. This is like a test case, if you like. It's a case in which the court has discretion. And that will affect how, from tomorrow on, the precedents will affect the cases that follow. Okay. Each case law court, if it has discretion, of course, if it has no discretion, that's it, that's the ruling it takes, can also affect what we call the breadth of the ruling. It can issue whichever ruling it issues. It can decide to intervene or not. It can do so in a narrow way or in a broad way. A narrow way means that it wants to minimize the impact that it has on precedents in the future, and a broad way it means that it wants to maximize, to make the effect that it has, the impact that it has on future rulings larger. Obviously, this is a minefield. Yeah, I'm assuming something about how precedents work. So part of the worth of what I'm saying here is how can I get away with assuming very little about this, okay? About how today's ruling affects tomorrow's state of precedence. And it turns out that I need, analytical are going to need only two things, and one of them not even for everything I say. First of all, this seems uncontroversial. Case law courts always have discretion in some cases. Okay, so it's impossible to be in a case law regime where the discretion interval has been reduced to zero. Okay, there's always going to be something that can come up where the court has discretion. And second, and this is I will say, but what needs this and what doesn't. But my very final punchline does not need this. But the problem becomes a lot more well-behaved if you introduce this, is that case law courts can choose rulings that have no effect on precedents. They can give them zero breadth. Okay, Alan Schwartz alerted us to the fact that this is a common sentence judgments that are published in the United States. They say we restrict the holding to the facts of the case. Now, whether that really reduces the effect that it has on the future to zero or not, that's a matter for debate. But they certainly can make a pretty big effort to do that. And here I couldn't resist another joke because I thought it was rather ironic. That's part of the U.S. Supreme Court majority decision in Bush v. Gore. And basically they say that they don't want it applied in the future. Of course, it has very little to do with what I'm doing here. This is not a contract. But I thought it was kind of amusing. That they were covering themselves so explicitly. So to remember, this brighter font is the jokes font. All right, let's see if we can continue with the characterization of what happens in the case law case. Now, remember that. I've argued before that if the case law court only looks at today, by the time the parties go to court, it has the incentive to take the wrong decision. So if the case law court were to look only at today, it will simply be lenient. It will simply say, well, you know, you guys have done this. Why don't you go trade? After all, that's good for both of you at this point. And I cannot force you to go back in time and undo the whatever wrong things you did. So remember, the present bias decision here is not to intervene, to let them do whatever it is that they want to do. Now, if it looks forward via precedents, it has an incentive to take the right decision, okay? Or it may have an incentive, because I've assumed so little on how today's ruling affects tomorrow's precedents. But if it affects tomorrow's precedents in the obvious way, which is if I void today, tomorrow the court is more likely to be bound to void, then if it looks at the future, it will have an incentive to take the right decision. That is because in future periods, these decisions for today are irrevocable, are still to be taken. So there is time to impart a direction to the future about today. There's nothing more that we can do. Remember, the right decision, essentially, the tough decision here is to intervene when the environment is complex, to intervene when the wrong transaction to do with the basement is possible. Okay, so that's really the crux of the matter as far as the case law court is concerned. Is it going to intervene when the environment is rich, is complex? Now, the effect, whichever way it goes, this is completely general. That's why we like it. The effect that the court can have on the future via precedents must eventually get small. Okay, why is that? The reason is that we're talking about an effect that is what economists call marginal. It's the change in precedents that matters here, and changes. These are things that cannot go off to be too large or too small. Change here is something that takes place in a bounded setup. Things can only be so good or so bad. So if you keep changing and changing, at some point you cannot change much more. The effect is what we call marginal. On the other hand, the temptation, in other words, the difference between, I forgot if it was 30, those two numbers, they're numbers that go the wrong way, that stays the same. In other words, the temptation today, as far as the current parties are concerned, to take the wrong decision doesn't change. Yeah. So at some point, the case law will, we think a good word for this will, is to say it will become mature. The precedents will be pretty good. The state of precedents will be pretty good. Yeah, but the gain from changing them will not be big enough to compensate today's court into taking the tough decision today. It will look at today's parties and say, well, okay, you know, future parties are going to be, with some probability, constrained by precedents, so I'm not going to bother and change the law through precedents anymore. So at some point, the case law will mature and stop evolving, that is, essentially taking decision B in environment M, and all the case law courts that have discretion will succumb to the present bias from that point on. Okay? So the courts in the case law regime will be able to take the tough decision only a certain number of times, and then they will stop. They'll be satisfied with the current state of the law, and then when the current guys go before them, they'll say, well, okay, bygones are bygones, you do what you need to do. Just to go back, for those of you, I know that there might be some who are worried about my zero breadth assumption, this is needed here, okay? The reason is that let me just utter four words of jargon. The reason is that makes the value function of the dynamic program monotonic, okay? So I can be sure that at some point it actually stops. This thing doesn't get into cycles. It doesn't get into, things have gone bad again. Let's try some tough decisions again, okay? I've forced it to be well behaved in that sense. This is the formal counterpart of what I said before. Essentially, it says start wherever you like as far as precedents are concerned, and now remember that this is a process along which a lot of randomness is realized. So in each period, you're going to have the type of environment, whether the precedents bind, and the court rulings, and so on. But you can think of paths through time here. And what my assertion here says is essentially that there exists an integer m such that the court will not take the tough decision more than m times. After m times, it will give up. Notice, and quite rather intuitively, this does not depend on with what frequency the environment is such that an intervention is required, for the simple reason that the court is able to change its ruling according to whether the environment is of one variety or the other. So, after the case law becomes mature, then courts have all the case law courts that have discretion take the present bias decision. Present bias decisions, remember, are good today, but not good overall. And the present bias, remember, has bite when the environment is M, when court intervention is required. In the case in which the basement issue does not arise at all, then both ahead of time and after the fact, the correct thing to do is to uphold anything that the parties wrote. The environment then happens a fraction row of the times. So essentially, my punchline here is that when the environment is very often of one type or the other, the lack of flexibility that I built into the statute law doesn't matter anymore. That's because if row is very low, you're going to take the right decision. You're going to write the right decision in the statute book, and you're going to get it wrong very few times, a very small fraction of the times. If row is very high, you're going to get it right. Take the other decision, you're going to get it right a large fraction of the times again. But if it's true that the environment is of the M variety sufficiently often, then the statute law regime is superior to the case law regime. That is because the cost of the inflexibility of the statute law is relatively low, and the present bias temptation of the case law courts is something that matters a lot, because that environment takes place a large fraction of the times. John is worried about time, but I'm not too far from the end. This is the formal counterpart of what I was just saying before. Essentially, it says, start wherever you like as far as precedents are concerned. Then I can find a cutoff frequency for the frequency of the environment in which it is correct to intervene into the contractual relationship. And if the basement issue arises a fraction of the times that is larger than that, then the statute law regime is better than the case law regime. Okay. Remember, when I say better, I mean essentially social surplus. Okay. We're looking at today the values of all transactions that take place, value minus cost, and adding them up through time, discounting the future at some rate, at some given rate. John is relieved because we're very close to the end. So, what are the morals of the story? Remember, I started with Cardozo, Justinian, and the Italian bureaucrats. So I'm going to start with the easy one first. That, believe it or not, is after he had a hair transplant. This is in Parliament, and this, I think, speaks for itself. there's actually a literature on this. In places like Italy, and even more so in less developed countries, you often find laws that are deliberately intricate. Okay, and there's some theoretical and empirical evidence that essentially this will help corruption, because it will endow the bureaucrats who administer these rules and regulations with further monopoly power, just simply because nobody really knows what the rules say. So I'm going to dismiss that as a deliberately intricate law. I think witness to that is the fact that the laws must have been deliberately intricate at some point, or overly intricate at some point, if somebody made a law that ordered the simplification of the laws. Remember, that's how that decree took place. Justinian. So this is the same mosaic as before. This is a photo, recent, I believe, of the Appian Way. The Appian Way links Rome and Naples. It's a Roman way, and I believe it's approximately 8 feet wide. At least it makes sense from my gauging of the photograph. So Justinian, remember that was not a deliberately intricate law. It just said straight roads 8 feet wide, curved roads 16 feet wide. Okay, simple. was it a silly rule? Well, one of the morals of the story here is that it depends how fast changing the environment is and how, therefore, you can make the statute book appropriate. I checked, and the Appian Way was, again, I know there's at least one historian in the room. I hope I'm getting these right. I think so. It was built in approximately 300 BC. Was not fully replaced until 1784. That's a lifespan of 2,084 years, rather long. In other words, the full trunk road that replaces the Appian Way on a similar but sort of close but different route was built in 1784. And just as a personal thing, I remember the part of the Appian Way that's inside the city of Rome. I remember driving my own car over the Roman paved zones even after I was old enough to have a driver's license, and that was after 1784. Was Justinian a wise man? Well, I don't really know. I'm not a historian, but it seems to me that basically there we're talking about a very slow changing environment. So that can be interpreted as either a very high or very low value of rho above, because the nature of the cases is almost always the same. It doesn't, so that can be in some sense interpreted as slow changing environment. The probability that the case tomorrow is the same as today is high, and a big statute book that provides thin homogeneous slices, in other words, slices of pools of cases in which the same ruling is likely to be correct, seems like a good idea. Cardozo was certainly a wise man. What are those? Those are stock tickers. The first on the left is Edison's improved stock ticker. It was introduced in 1871. This is the last mechanical sticker, ticker that was introduced, and that was introduced in 1960. And I couldn't find a picture with a person standing beside it, but I believe it's something of this type. And that's that was, I don't know if it's changed again, the current issue in 1996 in the New York Stock Exchange. So the only point I'm trying to make is that this is stuff that changes very fast, certainly compared to the Appian Way. So fast changing environment in terms of the analytics that I wrote down before, this can be interpreted as intermediate values of rho, so you're really not sure what's going to come up because things change very fast. There's a large literature on so-called law and finance that documents in large part empirically, the fact that common law countries do better as far as financial markets are concerned. This is one way to support those findings, which we find comforting. Those are largely so-called cross-country analyses. So they could also be picking up the fact that being a former British colony is good for your financial sector. Here we have at least one further reason to think that might be the case. So in this case, even if you attempt to write a big detailed statute book, you're not going to cut slices that are homogeneous enough. You're going to make lots of mistakes. This is what Cardozo was getting to in my first slide. So in this case, statute law is likely to be inferior because it is inflexible. And I want to conclude with just one more thing. Remember, I said I was going to come back to Cardozo's pessimism. It's really pretty strong if you think about it. There are only isolated dooms. I mean, for a US Supreme Court justice, that's a pretty strong view, right? I'm not quite sure why he says that. One thing is for sure is that case law in our in this setup is doomed to become mature, and after maturing, to succumb to the time inconsistency temptation that the courts have. Why do I say that? Well, because in the 1970s and following, started by Posner, another judge who does philosophy, not a U.S. Supreme Court judge, but another judge that does philosophize, that writes very extensively about his views of the law and about law and economics, basically sparked off a debate that said, well, look, you know, one of the reasons common law is good is that we can think of it as an adaptive system that through time becomes better and better and better, and implicit in that claim it was that eventually it becomes as good as it could be. Okay, it becomes optimal. Now, in this case, the case law improves through time. That's because I've assumed zero breadth, which I forgot to mention, by the way, is not necessary for my basic welfare comparison that in some cases case law is better than common law. But if you take if you think that the effect that we're highlighting here, i.e. that there's a difference between writing the contract ex ante, before a bunch of things happen, and the time at which you go to court, which is after a bunch of things have happened, then the evolution of common law, even under the best of circumstances, in which I've assumed zero breadth, so I've made this sort of go straight up through time, will not reach full optimality. And this, I'm not quite sure what Posner's current view is, but also seems to be becoming more the consensus view among many scholars. In other words, that the claim that case law evolves to being optimal was, in a sense, rushed when it was made. And I'm done. Oh.
Listening to Lucas talk just reminded me of a story I heard about the European Commission years ago, where they had a wonderful reception where all the people concerned with European legal systems had gathered together all the great tomes produced by the Commission that standardized and codified the entire system, and it ended up as a body of books and volumes that spanned the whole back wall of the room at the reception, and everybody felt an enormous sense of achievement. To those of us more conscious of the problems being raised this evening, it sounded more like a nightmare situation. But we have time for just a couple of questions before we close proceedings.
Yes.
Yeah, please.
I just wonder, how many assumptions do you have before you establish your model? For example, you assume judges are reasonable person or intelligent person, like Einstein. Or you assume people are reasonable people, persons, or extraordinary persons. What are your assumptions about judges and us?
Thank you. So, first of all, I assume that everybody is pretty clever, okay? But let me try and justify that. So, the fact that contracting parties are smart, I believe, is the right assumption if we want to say something that is of first-order economic importance. I don't believe that the right assumption to think about how BP negotiates a large contract is that they make mistakes. They're probably pretty careful. So if I want something that applies to big stuff, I think that's a pretty good way to go. Notice also, I might want to point out myself, that here I've strived to do something, It's not that if people are risk averse, this doesn't work, but I wanted something that works even if they're not risk averse. The reason is, again, BP, a large company, has a very diversified portfolio of many things, so they do care about risk, but not more than so much, because they know that they're well diversified, and about the risk in each individual transaction, they don't care that much. I've also assumed two things about judges, which you may like less, and I quite agree, but I think that my punchline is strengthened by making the assumption rather than weakened. I've assumed that they are smart. Why not? But even more so, I've assumed that they're fully benevolent, right? That they have, when they take their decisions, they look at social welfare, they solve this rather complicated problem in some cases, and they take their decisions according to that. Now, notice carefully, though, that my punchline here is to say that leaving things to judges is not always the right thing to do. So if this is so, even though I assume that they are super smart and super benevolent, this strengthens my point. In terms of work that other people have done, there is a literature on so-called judicial bias and judicial agency problems. It's not that I don't recognize that those are real effects, but because if I put in here corrupt judges or judges that for no reason take the wrong decision, and then I came up with a punchline that says, oh, leaving things to judges is not always good, somebody else would have put their hand up and said, well, of course it's not always good. You assume they're crooked.
Yes, please.
Professor Angelini, thanks very much for your talk. But I'm a little bit worried about this assumption that someone somewhere is maximizing the social surplus. I mean, I have the illusion, correct me if I'm wrong, who chooses laws, the legal frameworks, the governments. And they're either trying to maximize votes, or if you're Mobutu, you're trying to maximize loot. So,
thank you.
Who's maximizing the social surplus?
Several, hopefully short parts. First, I don't think this is something that gives us good guidance for poor countries. Okay, there are first order of magnitude problems that very likely have to do with corruption of judges, of governments, and various other humongous inefficiencies that run through the economy that distort all kinds of processes. Okay. So that's a good opportunity for me to clarify this. I don't believe that this applies to lesser developed to poorer countries. I don't think this illuminates very much. second part to the answer: not everybody here maximizes social surplus. The contracting parties maximize their own. Yeah, their standard, ordinary profit maximizing contracting parties. Now let's come to the comparison I made. The comparison I made was between an optimally chosen statute, yeah, and system of case law in which the case law courts are benign. The comparison of the two is, my conclusion is strengthened if just for the answer that I just gave 2 minutes ago. Why would people choose statutes in the optimal way? Well, obviously the Italians didn't. I'm not purporting that they do. It still is an important benchmark to work out whether you, provided you did things right, whether you could do better in one system or the other. Far from me to believe that all laws are optimally chosen, and far from me to deny the importance of. In fact, there's a new huge field of theory called political economy, and I wish Tim Besley was here. We exchanged some emails. I think he's doing something part of his current research agenda is precisely to look at political processes and how they impact the structure of the judiciary. So far from me to deny that those are important factors.
Time presses on, and I'm afraid that we really must close the proceedings. I would like to remind those of you who have tickets that to find your way to the reception upstairs, you go to the front of the building, take the lift to the fifth floor, and we'll see you there. It only remains for me to thank Luca for a wonderful survey this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.